Edinburgh.
Edinburgh.
How do you feel?
Actually, it's a pleasant feeling. I guess it's a smile. I just laugh at myself.
So a big part of me wants to just point at Bruce and go, what he said. So we might get a little bit heady now. So it's probably pretty obvious now that Vedana is really important. And as Bruce has been talking about it, primarily from the standpoint of the second of the four foundations, it's so important that it appears in a number of the endless number of lists that we find when we study Buddhism. One of the most important of those is called the cycle of dependent origination. And it has kind of a big name, but I'm going to describe it for you, and I think you'll probably recognize this cycle really easily. It's sometimes depicted as a wheel with 12 spokes. And when I first encountered it, I actually ran across a book in the public library by Ajahn Suchito, who has become one of my favorite teachers. And the reason I took it is because it had pictures. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware of the great legacy of Theravadan music and art, but there really isn't one. So encountering pictures is kind of a big deal. And he actually did a series of paintings. This was a gift that he was making to Ajahn Sumedho. And they're quite wonderful, and he did a whole series on this cycle of dependent origination. So we're going to spend most of the time talking about just a very central portion of this cycle, but I kind of want to go quickly from the beginning, because I think it helps place this place Vedana and the subsequent spokes, which are very important. So I was thinking about this. I was obsessing about this. And I had some relief because I had recently had a conversation with my son who lives in Brooklyn. And I was just thinking, I had a really good feeling about him, about how he was doing in his life. And I was thinking how this whole notion of, you know, we're going to begin talking really basically about birth and ignorance, the first spoke. And thinking about my son when he was a baby. Thinking about any baby, really. So we don't come here with much, you know, and nobody asked us if we wanted to come, okay, as Bob mentioned. So we really are here in a state of what some people would find more endearing to call a state of innocence, but really is a state of ignorance. You don't really know much when you're a baby, and you've got a lot ahead of you to find out. But you do come with sort of a payload, okay? And you may call it a genetic or an inherited one, or you may call it karma. But the ideas do come together quite well, I think. My son, for instance, I'm sure he didn't think he came with anything. At least he didn't know that. But he did find that out later in his life, that he actually came and was born into a family where there was an active alcoholic, where there was a lot of strife and tension within this family. And all of this inherited material, really, was part of the package that he arrived in. Apart from that arrival, there was a lot of learning that had to be done. And a lot of additional spokes on this wheel, which are acquired, the first one being consciousness. Right? But a certain kind of consciousness, that kind that tells us that I, as a subject, am different from you as an object. This dual notion of the world that we live in. And following on from that, something that gets called name and form in this practice, that is, that we have a class of things which are physical, right? They are comprised of the four elements, the physical objects that we have. And then the cognitive ones, right? Perception, feeling is also one, but not in the sense of feeling tone, but feelings. And then we have the six senses, right? Which Bruce talked about. So this wheel can move very slowly over the course of maybe generations, or it can move a little bit faster if we want to describe just the course of a single lifetime. Or it can move at the rate of hundreds of revolutions a minute, as it frequently does in our own lives. So that when we come to this next spoke of feeling tone, what's also present is this level of some level of ignorance, this some level of this inherited material, consciousness, this sense of subject-object, the six senses. So all of this is really there, and we're not conscious of most of it, most of the time. You know, just as perhaps you've never thought to consider feeling tone before in this sense of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So this cycle serves to explain the second noble truth, how suffering arises, that there is a cause for suffering. The feeling tone, so there's always a feeling tone, whether we're aware of it or not, it's there. And if we're not aware of it, it generally moves to the next level, which is some form of craving. Now, this too we may not notice, because one way of describing this at a certain level is simply habit. Just habit. So we've learned that it's very pleasant to have a cup of coffee in the morning. Right? And so when that sense of we wake up in the morning and a sense of unpleasantness exists because we haven't had that coffee yet, we go take care of it, right? We have our coffee. We don't really think about this. We have many, many, many of these kinds of just habitual activities. Not making any judgments about these at all. Many of them are neither good nor bad. Some of them, however, bear some scrutiny. So we can experience craving, or we can have this craving, even though we're not really aware of it from this feeling tone. And perhaps we're only then aware of when the awareness of the craving is kind of upped a little bit, it really becomes the driver, as Bruce said, to a tremendous amount of suffering. I visited my younger brother once when his children were young, and they were really young, like 2 and 4, I think. And they had this saying in the house which I'd never heard before. Whenever one of the kids wanted something, which 2-year-olds want stuff quite frequently, my brother would look at them and say, "Want it? Have it. Want it? Have it." Well, those happen to be the next 2 spokes on this wheel. Craving, want it? And clinging, right? Have it. Have it. Want it, have it. Right? We have a whole culture built on want it, have it. Want it, have it. There was a great song I heard not that long ago about someone who had gone out and gotten drunk and was sitting watching television all night and was on QVC channel and ordered all of this stuff. Right? Want it? Have it. And then when it all arrived at the house while he was away, and his wife received the delivery of all of this stuff. You know, this is such a huge part of our life, and that we so often fail to notice the impact that exists because of that. But we have this feeling tone. We sense that something is pleasant. We have this liaison between pleasant and greed, or I want it. We have a liaison between unpleasant and aversion or hatred. I don't want that. We have a liaison between the neutral, or we could say indifferent or ignorant place, deluded place. Maybe we're not, the feeling tone is neutral, but actually it's only because we are ignorant of what's really going on. So, unaware of the feeling tone, we're easily propelled into anger, into grasping and clinging, before we even know that this has happened. We've reached out and we've grabbed onto it, and we've got a death hold on it, really. So the reason that feeling tone is so important is it's the escape hatch for getting off of this wheel. Right? If we can bring the awareness of the feeling tone, in at this, at this point before clinging occurs, we have created a space to examine this whole situation in a much healthier way. We've allowed ourselves then to see whether this grasping out after this pleasant thing or this pushing away of the unpleasant is really what's going to bring us freedom. It's so easy to be caught up and, as Bruce said, spun around in this cycle of craving and clinging before we even know what's happening. Even on retreat, perhaps especially on retreat, it can happen. And it can be quite instructive. So on my my first retreat, retreats are supposed to be like perfect, I think. You go to some secluded place and it's beautiful and absolutely quiet and the food is great and you get the right amount of sleep and all of the people who are sitting around next to you are very well behaved and take showers and it's nice. So my first retreat was in Yucca Valley, and it was really crowded. There were 6 people in the room that I was in. It was actually difficult to get showers, and it was freezing cold, and it was right next to a highway, right next to a freeway. So this is out in the middle of the desert, and you would think that there's not going to, it's going to be quiet. No, there was a freeway out right outside the front door. So this is my first practice. I had done no practice prior to this at all. And I was sitting facing the altar in the center, in the back center of the room, and the door to the outside was right behind me. And about this third day, the wind started blowing. And the door would blow open 3 or 4 times during every sit, and this just frigid hurricane ripping through the hall, and I would be freezing. And it was a horrific amount of noise. And I had an unpleasant experience. But I didn't realize it was unpleasant. That is not in that way. See, because the experience kept growing and growing, so that every additional discomfort that I encountered kept adding to this level of unpleasantness. Until by the time of the end of the third day, I was a bomb ready to explode. And in fact, so I had a practice discussion. Practice discussion. And I mentioned this problem that I was having, and I don't think I was taken with the degree of seriousness that actually it deserved. Which mirrored to me in an extremely skillful way that my problem was me. Well, that's where the problem was. And so about an hour after that, I found myself out in the parking lot by the freeway, just bawling my eyes out, because it is what allowed me to get in touch with the tremendous pain I had come there with. Now, all of that pain was really triggered by my clinging to my idea of what the perfect retreat should be, and what should be happening to me, and how everything should be going along to create a really swimming experience for me. So this tendency to cling and to crave has this very strong sense of me. It's always something that makes me feel better, that makes me feel more sensitive, that makes me feel more powerful. And that part of this feeling, that is part of the feeling tone that can also be sensed early. Where am I going with what is drawing me? What is this pleasant piece that is pulling me in? What is it doing for me? Is this just somehow enhancing my own image of myself? Is it making me feel more important in my own world? So that's part of it. Something to be really careful about, I think. Really careful about. So this wheel is turning at its many revolutions per day or per hour. But a really helpful thing about this wheel is it can actually go the other way. So we can look at it this way, that it has, as we've discussed, that we have the feeling tone, and then we have craving and clinging, which evolve out of that. But what happens when we're already caught in the craving and the clinging? So these things all condition each other. There's a cause and effect relationship between each one of these. Unfortunately, in this case, the relationship can go both ways. So we can find ourselves in a state of clinging and craving. Be aware of that. And then we can use that to skillfully look back and see, how did I get caught here? How did I get caught here? Not long after that retreat, I went to the bakery. It was a bakery I'd gone to often on my morning break. And I walked into the bakery to have my little pastry and coffee, and I looked in the counter, and, you know, they raised the prices. They had the nerve to do that. They raised the prices. And there were quite a few people ahead of me, and I just kind of was looking at the counter and looking at the prices, and I was just getting really angry about this, you know, and so I walked out. And I was just going to be helping this guy behind the counter, and you know, I made some smart remark like, "Well, I see raised prices again," or something like that. So I was already fully in my aversive mode, totally caught in my holding on to my aversiveness about them raising their prices. How dare they? And I went, and since I stole my break, I walked around the block, and I thought, and I really had this feeling of that I was so wrong. That was just the wrong thing for me to do. I was suffering because of what I had done. And actually, I hadn't even done that much, but it was my whole attitude about this. And so I walked around the block, and I went, you know, there's only one way that I can think of to get rid of this suffering, and that is to go in and to apologize to this guy for my crummy attitude that I have. Now, you don't know me, but that's not what I do. That is not what I do. But, you know, this is the place where that is so valuable in practice, is that this is really where we can change our behavior. You know, it really works if we can bring this awareness of the feeling tone, if we can realize when we're caught in this clinging, craving behavior, you know, we can actually make significant changes in how we operate in the world. We can lessen our suffering and the suffering of those around us. You know, some of this is, a lot of it is about everyday habits. And a lot of it is about behavior that's much closer to home, much more likely to cause suffering. There is an element here of renunciation. And this is a word that we don't typically like to use very much in our culture. We don't like to renounce things, we like to get things. But I recently was listening to a talk by Joseph Goldstein, who had a really interesting spin, I thought, on renunciation. He called it non-addiction. And that really fit with my assessment of what goes on when I get caught in these cycles of clinging and craving. So much of it is just habitual addictive behavior. So what is the problem with giving it up? That the notion of renunciation, I think we do have some load about that, about what that means. But really, it is just this turning away from our unexamined habitual behaviors. Oftentimes, some of these can be really harmful, you know, and to get out of that addictive behavior. These kinds of things typically have a sort of a very enticing, sometimes enchanting quality about them. We get sucked into certain behaviors or enjoying certain things simply because they enchant us. You know, we like them, and we don't necessarily know why even we like them, but we just do. We just do. So part of this, thinking about changing these behaviors is becoming disenchanted. That is, becoming more aware of what's really going on instead of the illusion of what's going on. You know, all of the media that comes at us is quite skillful at building these illusions. Very skillful. And we have to almost be on constant guard against this because it is so skillful. So I think the practice, one of the goals of practice is to end ignorance, craving, and clinging through wisdom. And it gives us some amazing tools to work at the acquisition of wisdom. This notion of working with feeling tone is one of those. It's not something that we can work with constantly, but to simply be aware whenever we have this sense of being pulled into something, we have this sense of wanting to push something away, that pleasant, unpleasant. As Bruce says, this is often really a physical sensation. Not even that you might feel it physically, but the urge itself can feel physical, that sense of pushing or that sense of pulling towards you. So those are just kind of signals for us to pay attention. And if we choose to pay attention at those times, those are the times at which we can make this choice for liberation, this choice for freedom, this choice to end suffering. So those are our reflections for this evening. You might sit for just a moment.
Thank you.